The other topic on Christ and ethics, I think, is very important insofar as the question is whether the statement "Christ is my Savior" has already ethical implications. As I think the theological work of making the bridge from that confession over into our present ethical cultural situation, that theological work, I think, has to be done. Many consider it to be adequate simply to say, "Jesus Christ is my Savior." But I think the faith could be in danger, that is, the mission of the world to realize God's kingdom in the world can be endangered if you let it rest there. So I'd like to make some comments about that, and I'm excited about it, and I can go in that direction. But if we need to discuss the issue that is under debate this morning further, beyond 12 o'clock, then I will be here to do that. As I anticipated, the discussion yesterday on the political considerations on Genesis 1 to 11 did not come to a conclusion, and some problems were problematically understood. What I did yesterday was highlight, first of all, how the gods in antique literature acted in repressive ways. The parallel to that in our modern time is that we have a feeling very similar to the way the people felt in ancient times, namely that also we feel oppressed by forces which are other than our own. That is, the evil that surrounds us in the political and social institutions, the burdens of various historical movements, the ramifications of which repress us, are all upon us. And if we take the Old Testament and also extra Old Testament literature seriously, I think we can clearly see a parallel there. So that was the basic point. And I didn't get very much beyond that point. I tried to show that this notion of the repressivity of other than human forces, which in ancient literature is represented by the gods, how that notion of the repressivity is also present in the Old Testament. I did, however, always say that the Old Testament did something altogether different and altogether new, namely, it blamed the evil on man himself. Now that point didn't get through enough, I think, so we, I think, should spend some time on that. Let me, however, before getting into that, let me make just a few remarks to mention the gravity of the problem of the question of how sin came into the world. Maybe you know my teacher Helmut Thielicke's book, How the World Began. I urge you very much to read that book. It's a book of sermons that he delivered at St. Michael's Church in Hamburg, as all of his great sermon books are. Now, in that book, he recounts, as he has done so often, an event that happened in 1943, when, to illustrate the significance of evil and original sin in the world, in 1943, he was asked by youngsters, teenagers, 16, 17-year-old youngsters that had been drafted into the army. It was getting towards the end of the war in Germany. He was asked to do a Bible study. These youngsters were manning guns on top of big buildings, as I myself, as a young a boy, also saw them. We also had guns on top of our apartment house where we lived in Hamburg. And Thielicke was a minister at Stuttgart at that time, and was very mighty in the word, and these youngsters came to him and asked him to do a Bible study with him. That was not permitted because the boys were all in the army, and doing Bible studies in the Nazi army was not permitted. So they got special permission from someone up higher up in the brass. And finally, when a series of Bible studies could begin on the first night, there had been a battle just before, and the guns had been blazing just before, and he came to the group of boys, and they were in tears. The father of one of the boys had been killed in this air raid attack, which these boys tried against which these boys tried to do something with their guns, and the father was reeled in on a stretcher, and everybody was in great tears, and the Bible study was probably even more effective because of that event. Everybody was extremely touched, as you can imagine. But after that study, he went home late in the evening, and he walked through the countryside a little bit back to his house, and the countryside was as beautiful as ever before. But his heart was full with grief at this event, and he asks himself, how is it possible that the world looks so beautiful, and yet there is so great evil in the world? And this chapter on original sin begins with that story, and indeed I think we find ourselves in precisely this circumstance. And something else that I want to mention to you just before we begin: I was once touched very much by a little volume which appeared in Germany some years ago on letters from Stalingrad. Stalingrad was that big city where the German campaign in Russia turned around. Hitler had overextended himself. There were too few soldiers throughout Russia, and to defend that enclave of soldiers of German soldiers which had taken the city of Stalingrad, the Russians had surrounded that city, and there was no longer any way out. They knew that they were all going to die, but on the last plane that left, there was a sack of mail, a sack of letters. And the parents of the soldiers, mainly parents of soldiers, had received letters that their youngsters had still written in Stalingrad. And especially those letters that concerned themselves about life and death and God and sin and the good life, or sin and redemption, I think are highly significant, because here there is a situation of utter crisis. Everybody knew that they were going to die. And there is a whole spectrum of opinions about God and about man and about sin and salvation present in these letters. And especially two letters stick out in my mind. One young man had written to his father, who was a minister, and he said, if God is good, as you always preach, if God loves mankind, how is it possible that this big evil befalls us? I don't want to have anything anymore to do with your faith. Father, I love you as a person, but I cannot understand this great evil. This war is terrible, and I don't want to die. I feel lonely here. I don't have any friends. Everybody is just trying to help himself get along. There was a great shortage of food and fuel. It was in the deep of the winter. Snow was high. The soldiers were just sleeping outside in the snow and were freezing to death and didn't have any food anymore to eat. This person felt extremely lonely and couldn't understand how the whole question came up. As a child, he was trained to believe in God, but then when under severe pressure, he had to abandon, he felt that he was lonely and abandoned his faith. And that's the basic point that I would like to make this morning, that the abandonment of God, as I think in the context of of understanding evil as a fate which comes upon us as other oriented than ourselves, as coming from man, you ultimately have to say there is no good and man is lonely and the only salvation is really death. As in fact I think Greek tragedy tells us. And then there was another letter written by a young soldier. This letter is written to his father. The background within the church was not at all as strong as with the youngster that had written to his father, who was a minister. But in this other letter, there was trust, there was acceptance, the questions of good and evil were raised, but the youngster felt sorry for his parents because they lost him. He didn't mind so much dying himself. But he felt sorry that his parents had to lose him and that he couldn't participate in the meaningful family life anymore. There was also talk about God and sin and evil, but the question was left open. As a matter of fact, the Bible leaves it open too. It does say that man is at fault. But the question is ultimately left open. And to me, these two letters are a beautiful example of the difference between the biblical understanding or the biblical work on the problem of evil as it has come into the world, in distinction to extra-biblical literature. And the basic point that I wanted to make is that really the material is identical, but the Bible does something different. The Bible does something new with it. It reinterprets wonderfully the ancient mythology. Now let me just read to you Genesis 3, verse 8 and following to illustrate this, because that point didn't get through enough yesterday. Adam and Eve heard the sound of the Lord walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord after having eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But the Lord called to the man. First of all, it is God who comes to man. That's very important to understand. Man hides himself. He feels ashamed. Now you could perhaps say, if you exegete that, yes, there is a vestige of trust present in man, otherwise he wouldn't be ashamed, he wouldn't be afraid of God, he wouldn't even hide himself. But I don't think that that's the point that the Old Testament wants to make here. God comes to man, and because God comes to man, and because man fell away from God, therefore man feels ashamed and he wants to hide himself. Shame is a sign of not of the vestige of trust that man has in God, but rather is a vestige, is an understanding, is a sign that God continues to trust man and continues to work with man in this work of salvation that he has to do, despite the fact that man has fallen away from God. So, Adam and Eve hide themselves among the trees in the garden. But the Lord God called to man and said to him, "Where are you?" And he said, "I heard the sound of thee in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." And God said, quite appropriately, "Who told you that you were naked? Who told you that you were naked?" They had been naked before, and they didn't mind that. And all of a sudden now, they notice that they are naked. It's just like a little child who all of a sudden begins to see differentiations by the difference of states that arise in, say, life patterns. All of a sudden, things are different. You move to a different place. But in this case, Adam and Eve notice that there's something altogether different. And God asks quite appropriately, "How did you know that you are naked?" Being naked didn't bother them before. And of course, the point is that something had changed in the relationship between God and man. And this thing which had changed is that man had done something that he shouldn't have done. In the extra-biblical literature, the gods merely laugh about man trying to be good and doing something that is meaningful. Something that is meaningful is certainly knowing the difference between good and evil. And in the extra-biblical literature, therefore, man also strives to be good, to know about the good and evil, to drink from wells of eternal life, and to do those things which are necessary to get along in life. Vestiges of that we can see here also in the Old Testament. But the Old Testament does something altogether different with it, namely, it blames man for falling away from God and for disturbing the relationship of trust. Now, notice what happens then. To explain or to illustrate that the Old Testament really doesn't know what to do with evil, you can't explain it. The only thing that you can say, you can do is to fix it in man's existence. The man said, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree, and I ate." And then the Lord said to the woman, "What is this that you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent beguiled me, and I ate." And the Lord said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all the cattle and above all the wild animals. Upon your belly you shall crawl." And then there's this long passage. There is a church, a big old church in the German city Hildesheim, and there is a bronze door on that gate as a main entrance. And on that bronze door is the story of the fall. And the story of the fall is depicted in this way, that Adam and Eve hide in the garden, but God comes upon them and finds them finds them there, and all of a sudden they are naked, and they try to cover with their hands their nakedness with one hand. But with the other hand, Adam points to Eve, and Eve points to the snake. Now, this is beautifully depicted here in this succession of trying to trace the origin of evil. Where does evil come from? Now, the extra biblical literature I read there to you yesterday from the story of the city of Thebes, the circle is becoming complete. Evil originates ultimately with the gods. Not so here. The chain ends with a serpent, and of course the serpent is merely a sign for the lowliest animal. It is merely an indication that that sin cannot be explained. And perhaps it should also be added that if the author of this, who had worked on this, probably several authors have worked on this passage, if he would have thought in extra Israelite terms, then probably the snake would have pointed with its tail back to God. But that's not done. The snake is mute. The snake doesn't answer. The snake doesn't answer back to God. In other words, it is man himself who is at fault, and this becomes quite clear when you go along and read this long passage. First of all, because the snake was the originator, the snake is cursed among all the animals, and incidentally there is also a reference later on to man. This idea of the snake is later on referred to in other Old Testament literature, and especially also in New Testament literature, where Jesus turns out to be the one who kills the head of the serpent. Not only is the snake cursed, but man himself is at fault, so that it says to the here that God says to the woman, "I will greatly multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Yet your desire will be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." And then he says to Adam, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I have said that you shall not eat, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life," and so on. Man and woman are punished. In other words, the Bible clearly says that man is at fault for the evil. Now, I would once more like to indicate what the significance of this breaking of the relationship of trust is. I try to put this idea of original sin into the context of our modern world. The basic point that I wanted to make is that as the gods, and that is of course the common denominator of everything that I say, and it has to be repeated, otherwise we forget it, that as the gods were the ones who brought evil and repression into the world once upon a time in antiquity, so today we feel ourselves repressed by the forces which are repressive in society, in our civilization, which has embarked on the road of science and technology, from which we all have benefited a great deal of good, but also evil. But the Old Testament says that we are at fault. So that if reconciliation is going to occur, then we must deal with these structures, because they are our own fault. We are the ones who have brought about this repressivity in our civilization. In extra Israelite literature, it's possible to pity man. It's possible to have a great deal of sentiment for the evil that comes into the world, and this sentiment goes through all of Greek literature. Just read the Greek literature. It's beautiful, because there is a great deal of pity expressed for poor man who suffers from the hands of the gods. But we can't find pity for the alienating structures in our society which we have today, because we have brought them about. We are the ones who wanted to create a great world, but we are ourselves responsible. I would just like once more to review this this notion of the breaking of the trust. As the young man in the letter that he had written from Stalingrad, who gave up trust in God, felt lonely, felt alienated, no longer could communicate with his fellow man, but just needed to do whatever was necessary in order to sustain his own life. So also, modern man, if he feels oppressed, and we in fact have felt oppressed coming out of the Middle Ages, religion was understood as the great oppressor. I would like to mention that again when Carol Hinderly used the example of the psychiatrist who says that religion merely places guilt on man. Well, that's the sentiment of modern man who wanted to emancipate himself out of the oppressive religiosity of the Middle Ages. This is the way in our analytically saturated philosophy departments the development of modern philosophy is traced. That reasonableness can be achieved only by eliminating the fictitious mythology of religion that merely places a great burden upon mankind. This is the way modern man is trained as a person who must emancipate himself out of mythology and out of religion and out of guilt feelings. I find this very strong in our schools. Children must never be made to feel guilty. You must never make a child feel guilty about anything. Well, I don't think that's very Christian. I think children are just as guilty for doing things that should not be done as man as a whole is guilty for doing things that should not be done when they are commanded by God. But this is the way modern man understands himself, his predicament, that he needs to emancipate himself out of the forces of repression. And for that reason, yesterday I made reference to the French Revolution. The French Revolution is called by Hegel the terror of absolute freedom. And Hegel understood that this notion of a complete freedom, freedom from everything that has gone before, freedom from history, freedom from God's commands, freedom from what the priests have said as God's intermediaries. Priests were understood to be in alliance with the repressive government in France that went before, the government of the Louis. We must emancipate ourselves out of this repressivity and create something altogether new, building on a humanism of brotherly love. What came out of that experiment? Out of that experiment just came the reign of terror, as we understand. And we had, and the French government had to tie back into the forces of history in order even to make those advances in revolution that had been made workable. The same with the Russian Revolution. And if you read Rosenstock-Huessy, I'm a great fan of Rosenstock-Huessy, in his book on the European revolutions and the character of nations, Rosenstock-Huessy describes beautifully that all of the modern revolutions, beginning with the French Revolution, are different. They are based on ideology, on the ideology of absolute freedom. And because they are different from the great wars that have preceded and that have saturated all of European history, they are different because they are built on the ideology that man can create himself in his own image, and not in the image of God. Perhaps it should be mentioned, if you don't know this great man who's still living now in Vermont, he's a German Jew who has emigrated to this country and became Christian, and is in certain sense a fanatical Christian, because, you know, the converts are very often quite fanatical about what they convert to. But he is one of the great intellects of our time, I think, and he traces the modern revolutions back to this will of modern man to create himself in his own image. And of course, therefore, he traces the revolutions beginning with the French Revolution up to the Russian Revolution, and then the Korean Revolution, and China, and then, of course, after that, I suppose we would today have to add Vietnam, yes? Yes, Rosenstock-Huessy. I should perhaps write his name on the board. It's a German name.
Say it in English, please.
It's a hyphenated name. I don't know how you would say it. Rosenstock-Huessy, yeah. Rosenstock-Huessy. Now, yesterday I hinted at this. I hinted at the second major force that brings about this emancipatory movement as being science and technology. But I don't want to develop that too much. I would like our discussion later on to turn around the basic thesis that I'm saying. If it is true that we are responsible for the repressivity in our civilization, And if we take the concept of original sin as the Old Testament in Genesis 1 to 11 modified it, modified the extra Israelite material, which is also present in the Old Testament, if we take that notion seriously, then we are responsible for these repressive elements in our civilization. That is the one point. And secondly, if it is possible to see a reconciliation coming out of that fact that we assume responsibility for sin, as is clearly shown in the Old Testament, then it must also be possible to find reconciliation in these repressive elements in our civilization if we assume responsibility for them. That's a big thesis and a big problem, but I would like us to ask, how can we assume responsibility and bring about salvation and the repressivity that confronts us in our time today?
Can you repeat that first point, if we're responsible and if we take sin seriously, then what? You had 2 points.
Yes, if we take it seriously, then, well, a second point of what the Bible did when it reinterpreted this material was that is also the possibility of reconciliation. Okay, now, translated into the present political terms, that would mean that we assume responsibility for the repressivity in our civilization. And if then, out of that assumption of responsibility, reconciliation is possible in the ancient stories of Genesis 1 to 11, then also we should, in the parallel of our own time, be able to find redemption in our repressive political situation today, once we assume responsibility. And that is what we should do, is ask ourselves, how can redemptiveness be brought about in the repressive circumstances in which we find ourselves today? The Old Testament, I think, clearly points the way. We must assume responsibility. We can't simply say no, as once upon a time it was said, the gods have done it. So the Old Testament says, no, man has done it. In the Garden of Eden, the story of the Tower of Babel, Cain and Abel, and it's the whole story. We are responsible. So also we cannot say, no, it's like the French Revolution did, the corrupt history of the past, which is totally corrupt, must be eliminated totally. We can't say that, as the French Revolution said. The Russian Revolution said that also. Russian Revolution, I suppose, was slightly different. I don't think the Russian Revolution negated totally, but in the French Revolution you can see it beautifully. The past is totally corrupt, therefore we must, like the Sphinx that rises out of the ashes, we must create something altogether new. And that's a big mistake, I think. We are the ones who have brought about this corruption. We are responsible for the corrupt elements.
Does that mean, in a sense, that reform is more our job than revolution?
That could be a conclusion, but coming out of the dialectical way in which I think, that's also the reason why I made a disclaimer to the Russian Revolution. Now, in the workings out of the revolution, the dialectic, I think, was lost. This dialectic was lost because Lenin really was not thinking dialectically. Marx had taught something else than what Lenin had done with the revolution. If it would not have been for Lenin and the reign of terror that was created in Russia and the Russian Revolution, I think the Russian Revolution would never have come off. So I would rather take the French Revolution as an example. In the early Marx, you can see the dialectic beautifully at work, where a revolution is not necessary, but rather Marx always says, we must let the wickedness go all its way. We must let the alienation go all its way, and when it has come to the absolute end, when there is no longer any hope at all, like God going on the cross with Jesus Christ all the way to the end, then out of that, man will reflect and will reflect upon this basic dignity, and we, the slave, yes, he will rise up against the master when he is completely emaciated. That would be more the kind of dialectic which stays within the system. Yes, which doesn't say, okay, now we must muster up our forces and must destroy the past totally, but rather in the dialectical way of the procedure of history as Marx sees it, I think, there is something else than this total negation. Hegel called it pure negation. Hegel has a different concept to argue for this development of history. He calls it definite negation, but that becomes probably a little bit too technical here, and I would rather not continue in that vein.
Did the American Revolution have more of a sense of responsibility?
Yes, I'm not a specialist in the American Revolution. I have always seen the American Revolution as quite different, even though it occurred almost simultaneously. And even though there is a great deal of pathos of freedom in the American Revolutionary movement, but it is so very different, because we had nothing to rebel against in this country. Americans were far away from the oppressive elements in Europe, and therefore the conditions were created which now made England and also France really, we have our heritage, our cultural heritage from England and from France. We had this open, beautiful, blissful country which brought problems to America itself. But I have seen the American Revolution for that reason to be quite different. Let me just continue here. I have three observations to make, and then perhaps we can continue this discussion. First of all, it's very interesting that in the Old Testament, in the story from Genesis 1 to 11, there is nowhere mention made of sin, except in one place. Namely, in the Cain and Abel story, Genesis 4, verse 8, where God says to Cain, if you think this way, then evil is crouching at your door. I don't want to exercise through all the passages again in the Old Testament, Genesis 1 to 11, where in fact this reinterpretation that I'm talking about has taken place. In the story of Cain and Abel, you can beautifully see it. There is really no reason for Cain to feel slighted. Yesterday I said that Cain felt slighted and it was unjust. And this is a sign of the notion of the retribution on the part of the gods, as it was found in extra Israelite literature. Poor Cain, why should he feel poor Abel, why should he feel so despondent? We say in the in our Old Testament reinterpretation, and then this probably a secondary note was added, for if you feel this way, sin is crouching at your door. The Old Testament commentators are homogeneous in their judgment that this sentence, that sin is crouching at your door, if you let it come in, you will become a sinner, that is probably secondary and was not original with the Yahvist. Okay, but that's the only place in Genesis 1 to 11 where sin is talked about. What's the significance of that? The Old Testament does not mean that if I am angry, if I do something which I should not do, that this is the sinfulness of man, but rather that man is sinful in his very essence. That no matter what he does, he is sinful, as Paul says in Romans 8, and I wanted to read that passage to you because it's Paul really picks up this whole story of the original sin in Romans 8. It's Romans 3 verse 9. What then? Are we Jews, Romans 3 verse 9 and following, are we Jews any better off? Not at all, for I, the Jews, he's talking to the Romans or to the Jewish Romans. And of course the Jews always thought that because they are the elected people, they are better. And he says, not at all. For I have already charged that all men, both Jews and Greeks, are under the power of sin. And sin is here not the individual sin which we do, which Luther has always polemicized so much against. But rather, we are sinful no matter what we do. It's our very essence that is sinful. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks God. All have turned aside, together they have gone wrong. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave, and so on. Paul picks this up. Okay, now, the second observation that I want to make is that Genesis 1 to 11 ends without reconciliation. There's not mention made of sin because man is really sinful in his very essence, and the Old Testament doesn't even have a word for that. At least Genesis 1 to 11 has no word for that. And likewise, it is very interesting that there is no reconciliation in Genesis 1 to 11. How does this story continue? Abruptly, in Genesis 12, verse 1, The story continues, and God said to Abraham, so and so, leave the land of your parents and go into a land that I will give to you. But that is no reconciliation, is it? Yes, it is a reconciliation. The point is that God begins to work in history to work out the reconciliation. Now again, let me make a slight observation here. Salvation takes place as forgiveness in history. Again, the political ramifications are obvious. It is in the meat of the historical continuity itself that salvation will take place. Now, let us just review what the Greek literature did with the concept of history, of men doing certain things, because history, after all, is that which is done by men. We also have a natural history, history of nature, but I'm not concerned about that right now here. Sinfulness and redemption take place in history. What did Aristotle think about history? Aristotle didn't put history into the context of that which can be scientifically argued about. History was for Aristotle not one of the sciences. Why? Because Aristotle knew that history is made by men, and men act in arbitrary, unpredictable, and that means unscientific ways. Therefore, the events of history cannot be scientifically measured. That's precisely the point that the Old Testament wants to say. The Old Testament wants to say the arbitrariness of man is also responsible for the wickedness in history. And for that reason, the Old Testament story continues with the Abraham event after having made this profound statement, which is unique everywhere in the old, in ancient literature, that man is responsible for the wickedness that has come about. But all of a sudden, please note, we enter out of quasi-mythological language, Adam eating from the tree of knowledge and knowledge of good and evil and so on, we enter into the realm of history. All of these other stories make statements about the qualitative nature of who man is. And all of a sudden, historical figures enter. Abraham. Abraham is a historical figure, the way Adam is certainly not. And Abraham has, you know, historical places are identified. The city of Ur, which is has probably been in Mesopotamia someplace. All of a sudden, history is identified. The promised land is identified, which of course we are still burdened with today, you know, that the Jews live there in modern Israel. Again, the political implications are quite clear. Okay, and then I just want to make one third observation. In the historical Jesus, if it is true that God works out his salvation in history, then we need the historical Jesus. Jesus is the one who completes this work in history. Maybe I should leave it at that with these three observations, and get back to get the discussion going. Get back to, if we still have time, I suppose we do, get back to some of the points that I had made as far as the political repressivity which we have, with which we are burdened. Let's see, where do I have that? I have already mentioned the great revolutions and the emancipatory movement, and about the necessity to negate absolutely, but to negate definitely. I could develop that in other ways, but I don't want to do that here now. We do have poverty in our own world, and I mean poverty in an absolute sense. America is, in an absolute sense, relatively well off. So there is poverty, however, in Asia, there's poverty in South America, and poverty in Africa. The tendency is, as the extra Israelite literature has done, to say, this is not our fault. If we take Genesis 1 to 11 seriously, and then after that the whole history of salvation, we are made responsible for the wickedness in our world. We should not be surprised if we are going to be swamped by revolutionary movements, if we don't take action now, I think. We must share our weight. We must assume responsibility for what is taking place. So that's one point that needs to be discussed. We are responsible for the poverty in Africa and Asia and South America. And we could, you know, we could work that out. In what way are we responsible? And secondly, the revolutions in concerning revolutions in Cuba and South America and Vietnam and Africa, we tend to want to say it is not our blindness to real poverty, and it is not our exploitative politics, but it's the ideology of those revolutionaries there, and the dehumanizing politics related to that ideology which is at fault. I don't think that that is the proper attitude if we take Genesis 1 to 11 seriously. The third point that I had made also yesterday, the poverty in our own slums, right here in our own America, the poverty in our own cities and slums, and the breakup of the families, and the many, many myriad of other problems that are related to that, it causes us to tend to say in relation to that, it is not our clean suburbs in which most of us live, who are here at Holden. It is not our clean suburbs, it's not our intelligent, well-educated whites, it's not our huge automobiles that cruise through the streets, which are at fault for that poverty, but rather it's the lack of initiative on the part of those who live in the slums, it's the lack of education, it's just the slothfulness of them. I don't think that's the right attitude if we take Genesis 1 to 11 seriously. But then something else which causes even the middle class or the upper middle class to feel repressed, as ancient man once did, namely the alienation in modern commerce, the alienation even in those plush suburbs. We tend to want to say that it is not our jobs, it is not our wages, which provide jobs and... it is not our factories that continue to make jobs and money available. It is not our big corporations which cause alienation to us, but rather it is dehumanizing technology. It is forces which are out of our control. So with this here, with these, with throwing up these very, throwing out these very concrete problems, I would like to ask how we can tackle some of these problems with the guidance of Genesis 1 to 11, which pins responsibility on man himself.
You have talked about sin. Man is responsible for the problems in the world, and this, the things that he does is sin. We haven't really defined sin, and a question that comes to mind first of all is... sin, does it include, would you include in that more than man's arbitrariness to do things willfully that is wrong? Would you include with that, in that same category, man's lack of knowledge, his ignorance of certain things? Certain things can be avoided if we had knowledge. So since we are ignorant of certain things, we go ahead and do something and it goes wrong. Now, where does ignorance fit in with this matter of sin?
Yeah.
Is ignorance part of sin, is, I guess, what I'm saying?
Well... Yes, that is indeed a very, probably the central question. I think Luther has addressed this problem in his book De Servo Arbitrio, on the bondage of the will. He argued in that book against Erasmus, and Erasmus was for the clarity of reason, and he believed that it is possible for man to bring about that salvation which he yearns by employing reason alone. Whereas Luther said, look, Erasmus, you are just a fool. If you read that book, you just laugh all the time at the cleverness of Luther, at the dialectic understanding of reason. Luther argued with Paul, and incidentally there's a similarity here, I think, to the Thomistic understanding of reason. But that is perhaps something that the ecumenical dialogue must look at. That reason is not coming into its own as yet, if it is not a reason that is grounded in faith. We must have good reasons to believe in the dignity of human reason. And the reason that grounds itself only in its own powers is building a house on sand, as Luther has criticized Erasmus. That is the way I usually argue with my colleagues who try to develop a secular notion of reason that is not grounded in the absolute basis of human dignity, namely as being the creator of God. If you lose that relationship to God, if you get out of that, then reason becomes tainted. Let me use an example again that I had used yesterday. Supposing two people no longer get along, say married people, that no longer get along with one another, and they they increasingly get towards separation. They know quite well that the things which they hurl against each other are reasonable, are true, and yet they are untrue in a very basic sense. They are untrue because the things that you hurl against each other, the angry things, are the things are the points where the other is indeed vulnerable, which you have learned, but you exploit that vulnerability. Whereas what you really want to do, you want to live in harmony, you know? And so you don't really want to do that. Paul is so keenly aware of this dialectic of reason. He says, I do those things that I don't want to do, and I don't do those things that I really want to do. And this dialectic, neither Erasmus, who argues for the dignity and the sterility of reason alone, doesn't understand. And also the Jacobins in the French Revolution don't understand anything else but the absolute freedom of human reason. Reason, I think, is much more significantly argued for by Luther, where the complexity of reason, namely that I always... Luther said that reason can very easily jump into or decay into rationalization. That will, namely evil will, is always the motivator, and that reason then joins common cause with this evil will, so that you rationalize away your guilt.
Yeah. It seems to me that the way I look at this is that reason or knowledge is simply a tool to reach a goal.
Yeah.
And I can see reason and knowledge being, in a sense, what do I want to say, amoral, and...
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand the point. You say that not only reason but also science and technology is really neutral.
This is right.
Okay, but that's not true.
Well...
I mean, it has gotten out of hand. We have become the servants of that which we have ourselves created. How are we ever going to...
But that's because we have willfully chosen certain directions, certain goals.
Okay. Now you use that concept of reason that I've just talked about. We have willfully chosen, it was our will to do something that we shouldn't have done, and now reason has merely become the servant, the slave. And we continue, we little ants, we continue to build that huge structure.
Yeah. But I think this is leading up to another point. The reason I asked the question to begin with is what I'm really getting at is knowledge by itself is not solution.
No.
Well, you see, this is where we have fallen down in our society with technology today. We have...
You argue an undialectic notion of knowledge. You think that knowledge is merely crude facts, brute objective facts. Which is, I militate against that. There is no such thing as an empirical, crude fact or knowledge. For that reason, I look at the whole notion of having an encyclopedia as it came out of France, you know? Came out of France, out of modern France, this notion of the encyclopedias, which are a tremendous tool for everyone, I'm sure. But the notion of having facts unrelated to other things, you just have, say, Charlemagne, yes, an article on Charlemagne, and then right after Charlemagne there is some other figure, totally unrelated. Facts are merely, you know, knowledge is merely possible for its own sake, and it's neutral, it's neither good nor evil. That's a fiction against which I have fought for many years. Marx didn't know of any such facts. Hegel didn't know of any such facts. It's only with the development of a new kind of thought, which understands truth as only that which can be empirically verified, that this notion of facts, yes, let's be factual, let's be objective, we all believe in, this is commonly pervasive in all of our culture. I believe very much in being objective, but there is an ideology behind that which I think is dangerous, because ultimately there is no such thing. And, you know, I could quote Werner Heisenberg. Werner Heisenberg in his book The Part and the Whole. Werner Heisenberg was one of the great atomic physicists, and he has written in his philosophical autobiography about the notion, about the attempt of modern nuclear physics to try to come to the smallest particle, and namely the electron. And he said at that time in the 20s, I suppose, when they tried to determine what is the electron now, is that mass or is that energy, our concept of factual, objective factual data are problematical. He said that once we have come to the conclusion in observing the behavior of the electron once the electron behaves as a piece of matter, and then it behaves as an energy, you know, which you have between two poles of a battery, for example. You can't locate in a material way this energy. And he says, what does that mean? He comes to the conclusion that the very basis of physical science, namely atomic physics, must make common cause with a basic element of human sciences, namely that understanding, the subjective way in which I look at what I see, is very much a part of that which is being observed. And that's a basic understanding in the human sciences. You know, interpretation theory, hermeneutics, for example. So he says, to paraphrase him once more, this is in fact what Werner Heisenberg says at the end of that passage in his book on the Part of the Whole, that the natural sciences ultimately therefore must make common cause with human sciences.
Now, I don't disagree with you. I'm raising some questions. But then this, I won't ask any more questions. This then leads to the other question. If I understand what you're saying, man does not have totally free will.
Yes. No, that's right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
that's right. Excuse me, there was a hand up there. I'm sorry that,
Well, yeah, I guess what I was... I'm hearing you coming from the point of Genesis 1 through 11 as an allegory or certainly not a historical base of interpretation. My concern is sensing, wondering if there basically is common ground with what I call the biblicists, or those called the biblicists, who insist that this indeed is historical, and therefore sin really is Adam's problem, and we're sucked in because we're descendants of Adam.
Well, I
think
really
our
responsibility. I understand.
And I question if there indeed is common ground.
Yes.
I don't find any between myself and the biblicists.
Probably you have missed the point that I was saying. I said it with great trepidation that at the end of Genesis 11 and at the beginning of Genesis 12 we have a qualitative skip, and I use the word myth, which tripped me last week when I had a discussion similar to this, and people pounced on me and said, look, Adam and Eve are not mythical, and they are true persons. But I immediately asked, can you imagine that the snake talks? Did Adam and Eve pluck the apple? This for me is obviously mythical literature, whereas, and then I did make a concession, yes, the other information, it's very well possible that once there was a flood, which is also in the creation story, incidentally, it's very well possible that there was once a flood. I have read Old Testament commentaries, and they indicate that possibly, you know, there are archaeological rudiments, that there was a flood, but that's not really the point that the Old Testament wants to make. It changes that. But with Genesis 12, you know, the realm of history is entered, and I can well imagine that there was such a person as Abraham, and that there was such a person as Moses. I can well imagine that, and then especially with Jesus, you know, I cannot only well imagine, but it's a rudiment of my faith. You know, it's the cornerstone of my faith. Let Abraham be mythical, let Moses be mythical, but I need Jesus, yes? And I don't need only the charismatic Jesus, but I need the historical Jesus, yes? There is it's very, very important here that we don't only depend upon the testimony of the early community, which was not concerned with the historical Jesus, but rather I need the historical Jesus too, you know? So a qualitative jump was made at the end of Genesis 11 over into Genesis 12:1.
Did Adam exist?
Adam, I don't think so. It's irrelevant, really. It's irrelevant to me. Adam means man, and Eve means, it says in the Old Testament, it says in Genesis 3 what the name of Eve means. Woman, who bears, or what does it say?
Things just have to begin. That's what the story.
Well, you see, the point of Genesis 1-11 is to make certain basic theological statement about man's nature. Whether a man of Adam has once lived, you know, if it could be proven that Adam has once lived, that's fairly irrelevant, I think. Yeah, I mean, you can make statements about man which are true regardless of whether you call that man, say, if you make an anthropological observation about the way in which man behaves, period. It is totally irrelevant, I think, to say that that man about whom I'm talking is Peter Jivanovsky, huh?
Yeah.
No, I mean, grab a name out of the head, or John Smith. Hmm? It's totally irrelevant.
Yeah.